Welcome back, and in case you've just tuned in, it is Radio Veritas 576 AM, that station that gives you the good news and the good music for a change. And today we are giving you the good people for a change. I'm joined in studio by a young man who is a medical practitioner who has gone back to school. He is one of those men that are making us proud. He's one of those that has defied all the odds and all the obstacles that life has thrown before him. Dr. Sebele, tell me some of the obstacles that you've had to overcome in your life.
It's a lot. There are many. You know, like, for instance, particularly with education, you see. So at a certain point, my grandmother couldn't afford to take us to, like, well, you know, that it's always perceived that, like, a multiracial or a white school is better than
middle,
a black
middle
school.
Middle
school. Yes. So she tried, but she was failing at the time. So I thought, okay, maybe let me take over and let me try and speak to my teachers and see if they can assist me with that. So when I was in grade four, we started applying for bursaries to other schools. Oddly enough, then I got an opportunity to go write an aptitude test at a school. And then I went to go write and I passed it. Thank
God. Which school was this?
Huh?
Which school did you go and write this to?
The International School of Bukutatswana.
Okay.
Yeah, so I went to go
write. In Mafikeng?
Yes.
Okay.
I went to go write and I passed. And then, obviously, because I was from an underprivileged background, so the scholarship was a full scholarship. So basically boarding, everything, because I couldn't travel back and forth to school. So I got the scholarship, that's how I got paid for from grade 5 up until matric.
So that's where you went to school in Mafikeng?
Yes.
Okay, boys school, co-ed?
Co-ed.
So here you finish varsity and you think, I'm going to be an engineer.
Yes.
You get to varsity and you change your mind.
Yes.
And you get to medical school. What was medical school like for you?
First year, overwhelming. I felt like I needed to prove to my family that, okay, I'm not gonna like quit this time, you know, change my mind again, you know. Because the thing is, when I left engineering, I was like, okay, for me, I found engineering too abstract, because you do like calculus, like a lot of things that you, physics, basically talking about forces you can't really see. You can visualize, but you cannot see it, you can't touch it. So since I was into art, I wanted something tangible, something I can see, because art is very, you see it, you know. Although you need to get the emotion around the painting or something like that, but you know, most of the things are tangible. So I looked, which career, you know, is very tangible. I'm like, okay, maybe medicine, because I was great in biology, so maybe let me try it. So it was like I guess it was God directing me, because now in hindsight, it wasn't a decision I vehemently took, like, you know what, I'm going to medicine, I want to be a doctor. It was like a...
There was
like
no... Because some people say they have the passion, they've always known that they wanted to be doctors.
They
always played the nurse and they had the
my
brain.
My story was completely different. Medicine, I was never even in my mindset.
So you meet these other students who are very passionate about medicine, and when you are taking medicine as an academic study, and you get there, it's academic. I'm sure the first year is very academic.
Very, very.
Then possibly second year, it's still academic. Mm. Then when do you start going to the wards and start
seeing people? So in second year, our first block was anatomy. So we are six students given a dead body. We are in this laboratory, and then we have to like cut and basically like familiarize ourselves with the anatomy of the whole body. So in Pretoria, what they do, most in other universities like Vets and UCT, they do the anatomy program for the whole year. So in Pretoria, they are very, it's like military style. So they do it over like six or eight weeks. So basically a week for each part of the body. So we'll do the respiratory system in 1 week, and in that week you write the test at the end, and you need to pass all those tests and pass the block test to pass that program. So it was intense in terms of the amount of work, because the book is really thick, and it's not more about, you know, anatomy is not about understanding, it's more about memory. You have to remember where certain things fit, where certain things are, you know. It's basically it sets you up for what, now when you're going to learn the understanding. You're going to know, okay, oh, this nerve is here, so it supplies this part of the body type of thing, you see. So it was very, very overwhelming. And the thing is, what was more overwhelming is that everybody else wanted to know what's going on in the body, whereas I was like, I'm not really interested.
Yes.
You know, I'm here, yes, I want to do well, but I'm not really... you know, and I used to surround myself with a lot of eager people. And like, so my group was like, oh my God, it's so fascinating. And in my head, I'm like, but it's not.
We often hear stories of people throwing up when they see blood, throwing up when they see certain things. And
Did you have any of those experiences? I think maybe one girl in our class, but it's not something that's common. Maybe in other universities, I can only speak of my experience. But we only had one girl who threw up when she saw a dead body. You know, we had like an incident where there's a night where you can invite your, where like basically you're encouraged to invite your parents so they can actually see what you do in school. So this family had lost an uncle where they didn't know the whereabouts. You see, so they'd been looking. And
so you bring them to the hospital or to the school?
No, you bring them to the lab. Okay. So basically it's at night. It's like a black tie affair. Then the teachers like explain, oh, your kids are doing so well, this is what we do here. So they go into, if they want to, they go in and see when we cut the bodies and everything. So there was a family
who, so you actually get people's dead, real dead bodies,
yeah,
not dog dead bodies.
Yeah, it's not
like Batu. Yeah.
We are told that it's body, you know, when you donate your body for academic study.
Yeah.
But I really don't believe that it's like that with everybody who was there, because especially in my year, there was a family who came and they actually recognized one of the bodies as one of their family members.
Oh no.
Yeah, so it was a little bit of a dramatic situation, but yeah.
So you cut on real dead bodies, and it's a real experience. What is it like dealing with life, because it's like you guys hold life in your hands, because you're there at the beginning when people give birth, and you're there at the people at the end when people say goodbye.
You know what, it's a double-edged sword, I can say, because on the one side it gives a lot of doctors like that, you know, that God complex where they feel like their opinion is absolute. Mm-hmm. You know, but you know, for me, it's like it's a pleasure when you assist someone to give birth, or especially if it's a difficult delivery, you know, to assist someone to make sure that the child is safe, the mother is safe, you know, everybody is well. You know, for me, the greatest pleasure is when I discharge a patient from the hospital. The hospital is not a place where people go visit. It's not like the mall, you know. It's supposed to be a place where you go, you get efficient service and the best treatment, and then you go home. You see, the best part for me is when I discharge a patient. It's never a nice experience when someone dies, but I guess you get desensitized after a while. You've seen so many people die, you know. I mean, like with the plight of HIV in South Africa, like we see a lot of people, and it's a lot of young people, which is very disheartening, dying every single day. And I feel like the general public doesn't understand that the epidemic is still there. Yes, we've made tons of strides in assisting with HIV, especially now that every, like, even when you're diagnosed, you know, before you had to, your CD4 count had to be less than 200, then it changed, then it was 500. Now, once you're diagnosed, if your blood count, if your
test and treat,
yeah, blood results are normal, they give you the treatment, which is trying to curb the scourge of HIV. But I feel a lot of people still are very ignorant about the epidemic. They don't want to test. And we see a lot of young people, 16-year-olds who've been on treatment for 2 years, and it's not vertical transmission where they got it from the mother at birth. It's people who are engaging in unprotected sex and they're getting sick.
Should be people still be dying of AIDS in 2017?
I don't think they should be. It's for me, when you're young, like a 23-year-old who's diagnosed with HIV, unless it was through maybe like rape or child molestation, or maybe some other way except from having consensual unprotected sex, you shouldn't be. I feel like it's just being ignorant, like,
and irresponsible.
Yeah, it's very, 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 very irresponsible,
because it's something that can be handled.
Yes, and I feel like the thing is, with, you know, there's a problem with how the PR around HIV is handled. You know, yes, we were trying to destigmatize HIV, but with stigma, you still had people fearing getting the virus. Now with destigmatization, the fear is gone. You understand? People are just acting irresponsibly, knowing that even if I'm HIV, I'm gonna get the treatment. Others don't even test. They don't even care. They don't even wanna know, which is like failing people, because now you still must prevent yourself from getting HIV. You see, not that, not only that, if you're gonna, if you have it, because most of the PR and the ads we see on television is like, if you have HIV, nothing has changed. You know, you're still the same person, whatever. And yes, that's true, and I encourage that. But also, people must still prevent themselves from HIV. You know, so they still must use the barrier methods of HIV, the condoms, condom use, you know, abstinence or having one sexual partner. But people are just
reckless,
right? And I feel like, for me, the disheartening thing, like I'll say it again, is the amount of young people. 22, like a 22 or 23 year old, a 25 year old, even if a 30 year old shouldn't be having HIV. Like, you were born towards the time of freedom, so you don't really, you're not really of the old mindset of you know, you can't use condoms, whatever. If you're born in 1987, 1989, 1993, come on, you should be knowing about HIV and preventing yourself.
Wow, let's take a musical break. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back after this message. In case you've just tuned in, we are joined in studio by Dr. Stembele Mahals, and he's a registrar at the Chris Hani Baragwanath. He's sharing with us his journey as a young black medical doctor who's gone back to school and who's been practicing in the field of health. And doctor, before we went to the break, you were telling us about this scourge, but let's move on from this scourge, because we've had enough about that. I'd like you to take me back to your training days, so you finished your training after what, 5 years?
6 years.
6 years. Mm-hmm. Then what happens after that?
So basically, you get assigned to a hospital, then you do 2 years of internship, where you are basically rotating through the departments of the hospital, basically. Okay. From gynae to peds, to orthopedics, family medicine, psychiatry, all mm-hmm. the fields. So basically, you are given a chance to work in every department, because you know, as a doctor, you have to be, you're given a holistic approach. When you get a patient, you might come basically to a gynae hospital, but the problem is surgical. So you can't be like, oh no, I'm working in the gynae department, I don't know nothing about surgery.
You went
through internship, so you know what happens in surgery, you know how to treat those ailments. So basically, you do 2 years of internship, and then 1 year community service, where again, you have to apply to go to a certain hospital. So basically, just the government's way of giving back. So you work in a public setting. Then after that, you get accredited from the HPCSA as a private practitioner. So basically, if you want to go into private practice or open your own practice, mm-hmm. then that's only after community service that you can be able to do that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you never decided to go into private practice?
No. I grew up in Soweto. So even though I've never really been sick enough to either sleep in hospital, I've always known how it is in public health. You know, I know the long queues and everything. So if I'm also going to go into private, where I'm seeing 9-10 patients a day, sometimes if on a non-busy night, whereas I could go to a hospital where I'm getting more experience. You see, I'm like, in public, there's a large number of volumes. You'll find even international people, like from the US, from Canada, if they want to see a lot of patients, they come here and they probably spend like maybe 6 months, 7 months.
Yeah.
So they can, because there the volumes are less. Okay. That's why their healthcare is so good, because there's enough healthcare to go around. There's enough hospitals, there's enough coverage, and the government really puts a lot of money into healthcare.
Yeah.
Whereas in our setting is sort of different.
Different.
We have a lot of large volumes, and we have a lot of people who are living in absolute poverty as well.
Yeah.
So you'll find a lot of people not having access to private healthcare. So you'll find them sitting in the queues, you know, at big hospitals or clinics. You know, it's all that type of thing. And the thing is, the fact that we are the number one in the world with TB and HIV,
yes,
also plays a role. You okay. see, a lot of people, our immune systems are compromised, so they are prone to a lot more diseases. Hence, I wanted to work in public, because I wanted that exposure. Because even with that exposure, when you go to private, then you are like a super doctor.
Of course. Yeah.
You've seen a lot of...
You know it all. You've been around the block.
Yeah.
You've been around the block. Now, were there plans for you to go into private practice?
Yeah, I'm thinking about it. It's like, you know, the things I only know once I qualify as a consultant. If my services are more needed in private or if, for instance, of course you have to think about the financial aspect. You also, you know, I'm of the opinion that yes, you want to be a pioneer. Yes, you want to help people, but you also need to put bread on the table. You also need to, you, like, I want to be a success. So like, for me, having financial success is going to allow me to have influence over certain areas in life, so I can be able to assist other people who are on the come up. So if I don't have that money, I don't feel like I just want to be that, you know, a voice box where I'm just basically spewing out ideals and I'm not really actively doing anything about it.
But the argument is the money in your field is quite handsome.
Yeah.
Be it public.
But there is a vast difference between private money and public money. Obviously, when you're working in public, you are paid by the government. So the money is good, but it's not. It doesn't compare to what you get in private. Although in private, obviously, you have to have things like, well, you need it in public, but public, the government really covers you in terms of negligent case, when you are involved in a negligent case or there's a litigation type of thing. But in private, you have to pay like things like MPS, like basically an insurance company, where if you're involved in litigation and you're found guilty, then that money will come from the insurance.
Okay.
But still, even with that said, the money from private is not the same.
You currently specialize in, what are you specializing in?
Emergency medicine.
What's that?
So basically, you work in casualty. You're involved in all forms of casualty. Like, for instance, I'll make an example with Bara. Bara is casualties divided into segments. So you'll have trauma, which deals with, obviously, the hectic car accidents, things that are mainly surgical. If someone is cut, deep wound, there's plastic surgeons there, there's orthopedic, when your bones are broken in many places type of thing. And then there's medical casualty, which deals like with diabetics who come in DKA, this is diabetic ketoacidosis, people with heart failure, all those things. Then there's also a gynae admissions, which is like their own casualty. So those are the gynecological emergencies and obstetric emergencies. Then you have pediatrics also, when you have kids who are coming in an emergency setting. Yeah. So there are casualties divided so that you can are able to provide the people with optimum care. Because if you have a gynae emergency, a surgical emergency, like an orthopedic emergency, all sitting waiting to see one doctor.
Yes, it doesn't work.
Whereas if it's subdivided and there's teams working in those different departments, then it works.
Okay.
Yeah, so basically, when you're an emergency physician, you can work in all the casualties. Our job is to receive you, make the initial diagnosis, stabilize, then you can get the definitive management from the specifics. For instance, if I get a trauma patient, and I diagnose that, okay, he's broken bones, he's in a coma, probably there's bleeding, there's an intracranial bleed, things like that. I stabilize the patient, make sure that he gets the initial CT scan and everything. Once I have all those results and the patient is stabilized enough to be seen by the person who's going to provide the definitive care. So obviously I'll call the orthopedic surgeon for the broken bones, and I'll call probably the neurologist or the neurosurgeon regarding the brain bleed. You see, then they come and see the patient, we make a collective decision, and then the patient either is admitted to ICU or is admitted to a specific ward. So for instance, if the main problem that's preventing the patient from being well is the neurosurgical problem, then obviously it's going to go to a neurosurgery ward, then they'll get a consult from the orthopedic regarding the broken bone.
Okay.
So it's basically that we receive you, we stabilize, basically that's the real medicine. Emergency medicine, I feel like we get you raw, as you came in, and then the other people, then especially in a tertiary setting, then they get you once you're stabilized well enough that you can get the definitive care.
I'm told that you would rather go to a public facility, especially at their emergency section, because you get best care than you'd get in a private.
So I would.
Is that true?
Yes,
false?
I would say yes.
Tell me why.
For me, I feel
my doctor was actually telling me this, because he is actually specializing, by the way, and he says to me, for emergency care, he would rather be rushed off to a public facility, be it OR Tambo or Bara or whatever.
Yeah, because you see, there you get basically you have a lot of hands on you. You have the interns who are there working, the registrars are there, the MOs are there, a lot of nursing staff. Yes, it's still a bit understaffed, but it's a lot of people on you, you know. And the thing is, there's a prioritization in every hospital. When you're a red patient, an orange patient, a yellow patient, basically depending on your vitals and your state at the time. So I would advise like people go to a public health care when they are in an emergency setting, because you, like, everybody is there, you know. They don't have to call out, oh, there's an orthopedic patient that possibly might need emergency surgery. divine man coming. Because the thing is, with private, it's more of a consult. So you have people working in casualty, and usually those are MOs. In private, it's rare that you'll have a registrar working in their casualty, because registrar had to be located at a tertiary hospital.
Okay.
You see,
okay.
So because they're in the study program, and then there's a consultant on call there every single time to us. If there's some difficult case, then he can come and assist.
Unlike in a private setting.
Yeah, they are there, but you have to call them from home, and they have to
exactly.
come from home.
Okay.
Whereas most of the time in public, they are on site. Not all the time, I'm not going to lie. They're not all the time. They also are probably at home, but they are quicker to respond. Because our mandate is not, you know, private healthcare. It's, yes, it's about making sure the patients are well, all that jazz. But they're a business at the end of the day.
True.
You understand? They are driven by the capital. That
yeah,
they, need to.
They even charge us for a syringe that they
yes.
use.
Yes, so they're a business. But in public health care, that is removed. So the only focus is proper patient care. Because you also want good statistics. You don't want to hear people are dying at Barra because of 1, 2, 3. So we need to make sure that when you come in, you are stabilized. Whatever happens in the wards afterwards, especially from my setting, I don't know because I don't work in the wards. I only work in casualty. But when you come in, you are unwell, that's the best place to be. Because we're trying to stabilize you as quickly as possible and make good decisions. Because you also need to, you know, in private, you'll have a headache for 3 days and they'll ask to do a CT scan. What are you going to see on a CT scan for a patient with a headache for 3 days?
Yeah.
There's a lot of unnecessary tests, which everybody knows they do in private. Whereas in government, because we have to think about cost, so we only do the really necessary tests so we can be able to see what's going on with you. The thing is, another thing, you can't expose a patient to a lot of radiation just in jail because you want that money that's going to come with the CT scan. You understand? You have to do the appropriate things that are going to help the patient, or that are going to help in your management. If the CT scan is not going to help in your management, then why do you do it?
I'm told the medical fraternity is not yet fully transformed. How accurate is that?
You know, there's a lot of strides that are made. I feel like we're leaps and bounds ahead from what we were before. You understand? Because now we practice a lot of, like, it's evidence-based medicine. If there is no evidence supporting something, then why do you do it? You see, there's a lot of tests that we used to do in the past, or ways of treating a patient we used to do, and they were completely unnecessary. Because now we are forced to read journals, you know, to read about articles where they've made a study about something and then they saw its effect. Like, for instance, how we used to treat pneumonia in the past and how we do it today is completely different. Medicine is ever evolving every single day. You understand? So you need to always familiarize yourself with what's happening currently, you know, how to treat the patient. So it's not fully transformed, obviously, because we're not a first world country, we're a third world country. But for a third world country, I feel like we're doing well.
What are some of the challenges you face as a young black doctor?
You know, I feel like a lot of cases that you, especially in public, they are hit closer to home sometimes, you know, because you basically see the social injustices that are prevalent in our community. You basically, because like I said, you have the front seat to everybody's problems. So you sit in a consult and you hear about gut-wrenching things that are happening to people and children and women, you know. So it's,
and men.
Yeah. So it's it's very... I don't know. For me, it's disheartening because some of the people, or like for instance, if you grow up in the township like I did, some of the people I see are people I grew up with. You understand? And I see like a lot of things that are happening to them which I didn't know were happening to them. You see? So I feel like, oh, I could have helped type of thing. So it's a bit more of a personal thing for me when I see like people suffering that I know, or other black people who are suffering, or other black people who probably are just not getting the appropriate care because they're just poor, you know. Because for instance, like I'll make an example, how do you expect someone to take like you always say, okay, you take this medication 3 times a day after your meals, but do you ever ask your question, you ever ask yourself, do you know if the person is gonna get the meal?
Yes.
You see, and we have a difficulty with compliance with a lot of the black community, because either because of lack of education or just being irresponsible or just the other people, they don't have a meal. So if they're not going to eat, they're not going to take the meds. You understand? There's a lack of education, and we get a lot of patients who come in with liver failure or kidney disease because they still practice traditional methods of medicine, and those things are not tested in a laboratory. So some of the ingredients are toxic to the body. You see, the people come in with jaundice, and then we have to now I have to find out what was in the med first, because they're not going to bring Imbiza to the hospital and say, okay, there, we can take it to the laboratory so they can do a drug test on it. You see, so they come in already sick, and they've been sick for weeks. And that's another painful thing for me. It's like, you know, we have a poor health reporting behavior as black people. So we'll sit with a family member for 6 months, bedridden, sick as...
Not going to the hospital.
Yeah. Sick,
self-medicate.
Yes, or seeking traditional ways of medicine. Probably sometimes they're not person is sick, but they're not seeking medical care. And then, when the person is on the verge of death, or basically,
then we run with them to.
Or basically, they are at end stage disease, where even if you bring them to us, what are we going to do? It's basically it's around the time of palliative care, where you're just waiting for the person to die. And then when you explain that to the family, it's as if you don't want to assist. And in fact, you sat with the family member for 6 months, and they've been sick for all this time, and you never sought medical care. And then how do you expect me to now perform miracles? Because medicine is not miracles. That's another thing we see with patients, that you give a patient medicine today, they expect the ailment to be gone by tomorrow. Medicine is not magic. You know, the body has to get enough concentration of the medication for it to work. That's why they say you must finish the course of antibiotics for it to work. If you're going to quit halfway, it's going to cause resistance. Next time you take that medication, the germs already know what it looks like, what it does. So it's not going to work anymore. You see. So another challenge is, obviously, some of the departments are still racially driven. You know when you go for an interview.
Departments like...
Like, for instance, if you want to be a registrar, I'll make an example. It's an unspoken, it's an open secret, but nobody really speaks about it, except in corners or passageways. That if you're gonna go, if there's a 6 registrar posts and there's like 6, you're 7 and you're the only black person, and you have the same qualifications, everything, trust and believe, the chances of you getting that post are next to zero.
Wow, in case you've just tuned in, it is Radio Veritas 576 AM, that station that gives you the good news and the good music for a change. And Dr. Stembele is saying to us, the medical fraternity has not fully transformed. Very sad indeed. Do not touch that dial.